edition of the Hagmann Report. It is the 16 years post the attacks of 9/11/2001. And if you would have asked me on that day if I would be sitting here doing this, I would have said you're nuts. Of course, if you had asked me on that day if Barack Hussein Obama would have been occupying the White House for, you know, 8 years, 7 years after the event, the attacks, I would have said you're crazy too. And if I would have shared that opinion with a detective that I was with at Ground Zero, he would have punched me in the head, I'm sure. Looking at the blood-soaked, not blood-stained, but blood-soaked sidewalks and the deaths of the first responders, and our prayers go out to all who have perished, their families, who were murdered on that day. Now, our next guest, or guest this hour, is someone that I interviewed here earlier this year, Mr. Tom Juby. Now, if that name does not ring a bell, let me explain who this is. RCMP, Royal Canadian Mounted Police, Sergeant Tom Juby. He's retired. He's a returning guest. He's the author of Twice as Far, the Swissair 111 Crash Investigation. His resume would go out the door printed, but he's got 32 years as a member of the RCMP, retiring as the sergeant in charge of the Forensic Identification Section, Halifax, Nova Scotia, 27 years as a qualified forensic crime scene examiner, lifetime member of the Canadian Identification Society, crime scene examination training and experience for sudden death investigations, fire, arson, explosions, mass disasters, and major accidents, DNA evidence, location recording, and collection. And he got those stripes in addition to school the hard way in the field. And trust me when I tell you that it's not exactly like it is on television. And for his work, it's just an amazing, this man is an amazing man. His qualifications are just unbelievable. And he's going to be talking about some similarities between Swissair 111 and 9/11. And I would like to believe our audience is getting the best information from the best sources that are out there that exist. And so I want to thank in advance Tom Juby. He's going to be with us for three segments, and I really would like everyone to tell everyone about this particular three segments, right? Okay.
I threw you off there.
That's okay. Tell everyone about this broadcast. I think this is a critical broadcast. You see, that's why, better investigator than I am, a talk show host. But having said that, Joe, I know you wanted to weigh in here.
Just on a few things. On this day of 9/11, it's interesting to hear and go back and revisit to see what actually happened on my other laptop, which I have plugged into my TV at home. I forget where this was posted originally, but I downloaded a number of ABC, CBS, and NBC live broadcasts throughout that day, and they had them, I think, every 45 minutes. So you could download, from 8:30 to 9:15, 9:15 to 10, and so on and so on. And I was watching a few of those clips this morning, and just looking at the devastation and how fast all that happened. A lot of people never really went, like you said today, you encountered somebody that you got met with an eye roll.
Yes.
So many people just accepted what happened that day without ever doing just the basic level of research into it. And some of those people who have never looked into it or done those research will be the fiercest opponents of any kind of ideas that it's something other than what they were told. For whatever reason that is, I don't know.
You know, you're right. And by the way, my wife handed me a shoebox the other day. And it was on Sunday, yesterday, in advance of 9/11. And the shoebox contained, I think, four videotape cassettes. You know, the big black videotape cassettes.
Yeah.
Of the original news footage from 9/11. And I think that was on two networks that we recorded on. So,
well, when I said that to say this, that don't forget that people who looked into 9/11 who However far-ranging and out there of conspiracy theories they had to as close to the narrative, they were labeled as truthers by the media, by the politicians. And it was a group, if you were called a truther, you basically believed 9/11 happened differently from what the government said. And that was a bad thing. And that still is a bad thing. You don't hear it too much today anymore. But, you know, 10, 15 years ago, and we've had Richard Gage on, Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth.
300 architects and professional people.
300. We've looked at this from people inside of the government, outside of the government. Flight attendants have been on our show. I mean, we've done so much work on 9/11. And I would just ask people on this anniversary, if you have the time to, if you have not looked back into it, just take a look at it and see if anything else sticks out to you.
And before we bring our guests on, I would urge everyone to go to CoachDaveLive.com. I want to say hello to Coach Dave Dobmeier. God bless you. Coach Dave is instrumental. He's boots on the ground helping the victims of the floods, of the hurricanes, and doing so much for so many. And he's so much, so deserving of our support. That's Coach Dave Live, Coach Dave Dobmeier, CoachDaveLive.com. So just so you know. And, he's a great guy. So, all right.
And thanks to, special thanks to Brent Bileski.
Yes.
For setting this up with us is RCMP Sergeant Tom Juby. Mr. Juby, welcome back to the Hagman Report.
Hi, how are you?
Fantastic. It's great to see you. It's great to have you back. And if memory serves me correctly, you're in Asia, right? Is that correct?
In Canada.
Oh, I'm sorry, Canada. Okay.
Yeah. Okay. Not quite that far.
Okay. No, you know what? It was a neuron or a synapse short there up there.
I know who you're thinking of, yeah.
Okay. All right. Now, having said all of that, where do we start with respect to Swissair 111 and 9/11? You've got a resume that would that's really second to none. You're a true professional and a crime solver. On this very solemn day,
yeah.
And you spearheaded the investigation into the Swissair 111 incident. And how can we start? How can we begin to make sense of where we're at today with your background and your knowledge?
Well, first of all, there's a lot of people up here that would argue that I didn't spearhead. I was the forensic investigator for the RCMP on Swissair 111.
Okay.
I wasn't the lead investigator, if that seems to be a term that gets thrown around. Lead investigator for the overall file was with the TSB, a fellow by the name of Vic Gurdon, and the RCMP's lead investigator was an Inspector Latham. But my task on the file from start to finish, I set up the morgue and worked in the morgue for the 2 months that it was open, and then I moved over to the aircraft side and saw the aircraft reconstruction, worked on it, and saw about 15 MD-11 aircraft. I flew on them, and this is the Swiss Air aircraft, and I developed a background of knowledge of the aircraft and of the people who worked on it to reconstruct it. And I met a number of people and spoke with a number of people who knew a lot about airplanes and the materials that went into them. And basically, between speaking with there, and a number of those were U.S. people, Americans, who knew the plane inside out. And it of course is made by McDonnell Douglas, which is now part of Boeing. And
it was an MD-11, right?
MD-11 aircraft.
Okay.
On Swiss Air.
All right. And by the way, this took place on 2 September 1998. So
yes.
Pre-9/11. Okay, sir. Go ahead.
And it crashed just off of Halifax, Nova Scotia, killing all 229 people on board, more than 100 Americans on board, 100 passport-carrying Americans, and another, I think it was about 20 with dual passports, and American and otherwise. And the overall investigation took about 4 years, because it was in 200 feet of water, and it was a difficult investigation. There was a major fire on board, and it disrupted the mechanics of the aircraft. The MD-11 is actually a stretched DC-10, and it was one of the first fly-by-wire aircraft. Meaning that it was electronic, the cockpit was electronic displays, and everything was run electronically, or most things were run electronically. And the fire burnt off those wires to the point that most of the functions of the aircraft failed. And ultimately, it crashed about 7 miles off the coast of Nova Scotia, and it was a major task to retrieve it, and it had hit the water in such a fashion that it totally demolished the hull of the aircraft. It broke it into small pieces.
Okay.
From that, we were able to put things together, and the overall investigation was run as a safety investigation by the Transportation Safety Board of Canada, which is equivalent to your NTSB, National Transportation Safety Board. And the thing to keep in mind with the TSB is that they solely conduct a safety investigation, in that they go in and look for the safety aspect of something, not the criminal aspect. And there's a major difference there. There's a tremendous difference, because you can look at one thing and, as a safety investigator, see that it's faulty and needs to be repaired, needs to be changed. These
looks like we lost Mr. Juby. We will get him back. My obviously my question would be, you know, what is standard operating procedure? Do you limit the scope of investigation right off the bat by making it a safety operation, or do you let the investigators come back with their general findings and then determine?
You know, from interviewing Mr. Juby before, it's my understanding that you approach it as a crime scene, as you would a crime scene. And I think that's, and it's interesting because, Swiss Air 111 and the events of 9/11 were not treated as criminal acts. And that's an important distinction. That's extremely important. Our guest he was a liaison with the FBI and other U.S. authorities during this time. And there was a lot of information that, how can I put this, that was, I'm going to say, rejected. And you heard, Mr. Juby, as soon as he comes back here, okay, I guess we do have him back so he can finish his thought.
I don't know what happened there, Doug. It just all of a sudden went off.
Well, you know something, sir, we get a lot of that. I don't know what happened, but somebody just pulled the plug, you know.
Blame it on the hurricane, I guess.
Yeah, sure. Well, we'll continue with your thoughts, because this is fascinating, and there are so many integral moving parts to these investigations. But as you said, though, this was not treated as a criminal investigation. This was a safety investigation, right?
This is a safety investigation. Right. It's like you got a traffic accident on the road, and the the highway people come along and look at the road and say the road is faulty, or somebody says the car is faulty, well, what about the fact that the driver may have been drunk, or he was speeding, or what have you? And there's the criminal aspect of it. Well, the same with this crash. What caused the fire? And the Transportation Safety Board looked at it as a safety thing only, and determined that not with any amount of proof, not with any proof that I was satisfied in when they told me, that it was a short-circuited wire. And I say that because without any proof, because we had proof to the other side, to the criminal aspect. We had done highly specialized scientific testing of the short-circuited wires. The fire had created a number of short circuits in the electrical system, and we tested those, and the doctor who did so found trace evidence of magnesium, iron, and aluminum that in the amounts that he could not account for on the aircraft. And his explanation was that it's the trace evidence of an incendiary device.
Exactly. Exactly. Components thereof. Okay, go ahead. Go ahead.
His very first report that he put out, he used the word sabotage in his report to describe the cause of the fire. This guy is a PhD. He had 20 years using the equipment. He had more knowledge in geology and chemicals, and I mean, my background is limited, but it's nothing compared to his. And some of the things that he told me that he did as a student with different chemicals and whatnot, I looked at him and said, "You gotta be crazy." But that's like, it was like Play-Doh with him using different things. And it was fantastic to sit and talk to him and listen to him. And he explained all of these chemicals. And he said, "You realize what you had on that plane?" And I said, "Yeah, I think so, but you're going to tell me." He said, "You had a sender device."
All right.
And this guy had, like, his qualifications were tremendous. And my bosses, when I told them, they poo-pooed the idea and said, "No, he doesn't know what he's talking about." Really? And the TSB tried to shut down that testing.
Boy, this does sound familiar, doesn't it? Now, we're talking, a tremendous loss of life, 215 passengers, 14 crew.
Yeah.
229 in all souls that perished on that day. And this is 3 years before 9/11, a couple of years after TWA 800. And we've heard this story before, haven't we?
That report that I mentioned that had sabotage in it, it was received by the TSB at the end of November, the last week of November, 2000. That was 9.5 months prior to 9/11. And 9.5 months. Mm. What happened on the 28th of November, I had a discussion with an FAA member, your federal, the aeronautical administration in the States. And I had known her. I'd worked with her on the file. She was in the burn unit down in Atlantic City. And we had a discussion about the aluminum, magnesium, and iron. Just a very short discussion. And what's happening with it? And I said, we still haven't solved where it's come from. And she was there for a meeting with the TSB, an overall meeting, invite only, that I wasn't allowed to attend. And she said, how come we haven't heard about this in the meeting? And my comment to her was, this isn't in the area of the TSB. It's not a safety thing. It's criminal. And she looked at me and she said, have you been told to keep quiet about this? And I just looked at her and she said, yeah, I thought so. And obviously she went off to talk to the head of the TSB, and I think she was told there's nothing to this. Because 2 days later, I was hauled into the office with the TSB and my bosses and severely reprimanded for speaking with her and disclosing that information.
Same template. Say, we've seen this happen before, where the information you have, I mean, you were throttled, you were gagged, and the investigation, it seems to me, was compartmentalized, wasn't it?
Very much so. 2 months later, I was hauled into another meeting, and my bosses, four of them, demanded that I change my notes. I remove things from my notes. And I have the piece of paper that they gave me that said that I would remove stuff from my notes. I never did. My reason for signing it was to obtain the piece of paper. A copy of it is on my website. And I needed that piece of paper to prove that these guys were obstructing justice. That's a criminal code offense in Canada, same as in the States. And it's, you go to jail for 14 years. This is a serious offense, and not a thing has been done about it.
Even at this date,
not a thing. In fact, I was told by a very, very senior officer of the RCMP, I have it on paper, and it's again on my website, and it would have come out of the commissioner's office, which would be equivalent to the head of your FBI, came out of his office, that it was within the RCMP Act for the officer to tell me to change my notes. I searched the RCMP Act, and it is not there. But it looks good on paper, especially when it's given to the press. And, oh yeah, it's okay, not a problem. Well, it's a crime. It's a serious crime, and it's never been dealt with.
And I have to tell you something, folks. Here we have retired RCMP Sergeant Tom Juby, effectively a whistleblower, getting the truth out there, but being gagged by those who don't want the truth to be known. And this is where we're at. This is our guest. He's the author of Twice as Far, the Swiss Air 111 Crash Investigation. And I would urge everyone, if you've, it's an engaging investigative book account of the investigation. And he does a remarkable job in explaining the details behind that and the backstory behind that. Now, as we approach the bottom of the hour network break, which we do have to take this hour, again, our guest is Tom Juby, retired RCMP, and his book, Twice as Far, the Swiss Air 111 Crash Investigation. Some similarities, by the way, between Swiss Air 111 and 9/11. As we discuss this with Sergeant Tom Juby. So Tom, we're going to be taking about a 3 minute bottom of the hour break here, and on the other side, if we can discuss the findings, what happened after, you know, subsequent to all of this, the throttling of this, as we approach that fateful day 16 years ago.
Yeah. You know, one thing I find really interesting about this is the voice recorder box, as well as the cockpit flight recorder, were both went off 6 minutes before the crash, and the cockpit recorder went off just a few seconds, close to a minute maybe, after the regular voice recorder.
I think Tom might have some.
I want to ask about that, because what we're told is the reason for the crash was a fire, and you know, was there evidence that the fire burned out those systems that would make them stop recording? I think maybe we can pick up there on the other side. But folks, if you're like me, I'm 34 years old, I did not hear about this, or I have not familiarized myself with this investigation. It's kind of, to me, and when I read it earlier today, the Swissair 111 crash, it was kind of obscure. I wonder how many other listeners out there.
The background, Joe, is Sergeant Juby was on with us.
Right.
Was on with me. I think it was April or May, and you can go back and listen to that interview. What an incredible interview that was. It blew my hair back. It really did.
Well, when we come back, we're going to talk with Tom Juby again, author of Twice as Far, the Swissair 111 crash investigation, about a number of things that not only relate to the investigation, but elements that tie the Swissair 111 crash and 9/11 together. Folks, we'll be right back after this break. Don't go anywhere.
Visit HagmanReport.com for the news and articles that matter most. Stay tuned. We will be right back.
There shall be great tribulation, such as was not since the beginning of the world to this time. No, nor ever shall be.
Folks, I'm going to direct your attention to MasterPreps.com. MasterPreps.com. Wow. MasterPreps.com, the sponsor of our show, MasterPreps.com. That's MasterPreps.com. Take a visit there. High-quality items, made-in-America items. I mean, anything, everything you could possibly want, from cooking utensils, cooking frying pans. It'll blow you away. Absolutely, Erickson.
It's insane. I mean, wow, look at the products.
Folks, visit MasterPreps.com. Again, welcome to the Hagman and Hagman Report family, MasterPreps.com. I mean, wow, it's insane.
MasterPreps.com. Are you ready for what comes next?
Hi, I'm Grace Gonzalez from Chang Close in the Woods. We are an American family-owned company founded and built on skills and knowledge gained from responding to 18 major disasters in the U.S. and around the world. We found that most people don't have enough food and water to survive, let alone any medicinals to save their life. We are offering 25% off our must-have American Heritage Army kit. It contains 12 homeopathic remedies, a booklet that goes over everything in your kit, and our brand new book, Major Disasters Lessons Learned. Just enter coupon code HAGMAN. In life or a disaster, you must be able to take care of yourself. You may not be a medical doctor, and your grandmother and your great-grandmother probably weren't either, but they still knew how to minister to their family's health issues, and so can you. Check out our American Heritage Army's kit at www.changelessthewoods.com. Your life may depend on it.
Hello, everyone. This is Joe Charles, the guy whose voice is heard announcing for the Hagman and Hagman Report right here on YouTube and across the Global Star Radio Network. There have been many people wondering whose music is being played during those breaks. Well, you guessed it. And we're very pleased to announce that all that music and 11 brand new songs from the CD New Jerusalem is set for release on April 10th for download on iTunes. That means you can help support my ministry and be blessed by this awesome, inspiring recording. I have been fortunate to work with some phenomenal musicians from around the world that helped us put this recording together in the studio. Simply go to joecharlesmusic.com and click on the iTunes link. Or, if you'd rather have a CD, we'll send one right out to you. Just leave me your email and we'll get right back to you. And thanks to Doug and Joe Hagman for making this all possible. God bless.
the retired RCMP Sergeant Tom Juby. He was the chief forensic investigator of Swiss Air Flight 111. By the way, that happened in 1998, a couple of years after TWA 800, a number of years after Lockerbie, a couple of years after the first World Trade Center bombing. And the reason I bring these up, and 3 years before 9/11, and the reason I bring all of these up is because people need to understand the RCMP is an extremely powerful organization. They're equivalent to, for example, the combination of the FBI, CIA, and suffice it to say, those two groups are the bevy of intelligence agencies here in the United States. So we have with us a man who was part of an integral part of the RCMP, a very important member of the RCMP in terms of forensics. And it's important for people to understand as well that there was no investigation according to evidentiary procedure in a court of law on two of those events, at least two of those events that I mentioned. And it's also important for people to understand that RCMP had a presence at the World Trade Center bombing with the FBI as well. So it's in 93, that is. So we're going to be getting into that in a little bit, and well, much more with our guest Tom Juby, the author of Twice as Far, the Swiss Air 111 crash investigation, which I really recommend. And if you're watching this on YouTube, you can see it on the screen right there. It was published earlier this year, and it really is a fantastic book, written by an investigator with impeccable credentials. Before we get back to Mr. Juby, I want to mention one thing. I'm going to kick it to Joe then. One thing I want to mention is, folks, if you have not done so already, go to HagmanReport.com. Author Peter Barry Chowka has written a number of extremely important articles that you need to read. Extremely critical. I'll be talking about the articles tomorrow in my radio program in the morning. Extremely important. And he sent me an email earlier. I owe him a phone call. I got to tell you what a patient man he is. But the information that he's provided you, the readers of our platform, is just second to none, and I thank him for that. Joe, go ahead.
Yeah, just real quick, I want to bring you a quick word from one of our sponsors, Greenovative. Folks, just want to give a shout out to Alan Riggs, the owner of Greenovative, as he is going back to his estate in Florida where his house and business are. And he texted me today, said he was heading back there, that his roof was missing on his business, but he was not there. So he is heading back to try to get that all fixed. Just want to bring you a quick word from his company, Greenovative. They've been with us for a year this month, and many in the Hagman audience have enjoyed Greenovative products and asked for Alan to make modifications and give more power. Folks, this will deliver power to you anytime, anywhere, day or night, and you have a 12% discount on their complete packages. And you will be glad that you went with Greenovative. They recharge batteries with a number of different packages that you can buy. And the different size packages only differentiates on how many batteries you can recharge and how quickly you want to recharge them. There's really no end if you want to recharge 100,000 batteries. There's packages that Alan Riggs has together that you can do this. So, folks, when you need this, you'll be glad you did. Greenovative.com is the website. Give Alan Riggs a call. Send him an email if you have any questions, comments, or concerns. And he's our go-to for all your rechargeable battery power.
Thanks for your patience, Sergeant Tom Juby. Let's continue with what you were saying before. This information, when you start connecting the dots, as you have, is just absolutely mind-boggling.
Yeah, you had mentioned before the break about the microphone and the data recorder.
Yes.
And whatnot. The fire was so extensive that what happened was it burnt off the power supply to those systems, and the batteries on them wasn't sufficient to maintain them. Plus, the fire was so extensive that most of the wiring between the cockpit and the aft of the plane anything that went overhead was destroyed. So there was a total breakdown in the system, and that's why it went dead 6 minutes before the actual crash.
Okay.
The exact time of the crash was determined through seismic recordings, because it registered on several local seismic systems.
How's that possible? I mean, it hit the water, right?
Water is like cement when you come into it. And he would have come into it at about 350 miles an hour.
Okay. Yeah. As one in my younger days, forgetting to let go of the rope when you fall off of water skis, I can attest to the fact that it's pretty hard when you hit it. Yeah. Okay.
That's only a few miles per hour compared to the plane.
Exactly. Exactly. Wow. All right. So your investigation, and again, this was kind of like a comparable to an insurance kind of investigation as opposed to a criminal investigation, Swiss Air 111, and you found trace evidence, in your investigation, trace evidence of explosive material, components thereof was found, not reported or not made it read into the official report. That's fair to say, correct?
Yeah, it was totally covered up in the TSB's report. They didn't. The system that was used, the scientific system that was used, they argued that it was unreliable, and they never mentioned magnesium and the aluminum iron combination. They used the term incendiary device only to say that none had been found.
Okay.
And you know, by its very nature, an incendiary device burns up. That's its whole purpose. And I asked them, what did they expect to find? Something with a sign on it that says, I am an incendiary device? Because that's what it would have taken.
Okay. So how did it get there? Who put it there? And I realize that some of this might would call for perhaps some speculation, but in the pre 9/11 days, but post Lockerbie, post TWA 800, although that's whatever. What's your gut? What's the evidence telling you? I mean, with respect to
the evidence is that within the first week of the investigation, it's standard for the all of the employees who had worked on the aircraft to be interviewed to see who they are, what they did on the plane, what have you. And when the fellows went down to New York to interview those people, one person could not be found. He had worked the one shift, serviced the interior cabin area of the Swiss Air MD-11, flight 111, and was never seen again. When they checked his identification, it was false. It was all bogus, and they do not know to this day who that individual was, or where he went, where he came from, or what his affiliation was.
Yeah, that's right out of a TV show, what you just described. So here you have a man coming up on to examine this crash, and
no, the one that worked on the
oh,
the,
okay,
the
I'm
mechanic.
Sorry.
Even
worse.
Are we looking? Am I right? Or
he's yeah. You've got a guy that gets onto the plane, coveralls with whatever shoulder flashes, or you know, whatever, United, Swiss Air, or whoever, they're not difficult to come by. So he comes on the plane wearing one of those, and he does his tinkering overhead in the area where the burn occurred.
And this was witnessed, because I remember the earlier, and folks, go back to the we'll put a link to the previous interview, but okay, So is this a terrorist, or is this, I mean, well, who would do this, I guess, is my question. And have the ability to.
Well, what happened when we learned of the trace evidence and the incendiary device? At about that time, one of the other investigators was, he had been tasked with the idea that supposing there's a criminal involvement to this file, who could have done it? And he was in touch with the FBI and various other agencies, and this unknown agent or an unknown group called Al-Qaeda, they surfaced, and Osama bin Laden. Now, at that time, nobody knew who they were except a few people in the U.S. We didn't know in the hangar until Carl dug this stuff out and explained it all to us. And it turns out that the FBI in the U.S. had been working the Al-Qaeda connection to Yusuf Ramzi, Ramzi Yusuf. He was the World Trade Center 1 bomber, the first bomber.
Correct. Right.
And he's the guy that had the van that blew up beside the main column, and he was able to escape. And it turns out that he fled to Manila in the Philippines, and actually got onto a plane and left a bomb on board that ended up killing one of the passengers when it ultimately went off. He left it on board, got off at the next stop, and somebody else grabbed his seat, and he died. Now, Yusuf had plans to take down a dozen 747 airliners as they flew across the Pacific that would have killed 4,000 people in the neighborhood of that many.
Project Bojinka, I believe it was, correct?
Yeah, and he also had plans to assassinate the Pope.
Okay.
And
all right.
Luckily for all of us, and unlucky for him, his bomb-making efforts fizzled out. He had an explosion in his lab, had to run out, and when the authorities arrived, he fled off to Pakistan, and was ultimately arrested by U.S. authorities over there in the embassy when he was pointed out by an informant. And is presently doing time in jail down in your country.
Okay. Right.
He belongs. He had Al-Qaeda connections, and your FBI at the time of our guys going down in 1999 had more than 100 agents in the World Trade Center covering that file and investigating Al-Qaeda.
And this is where John O'Neill comes in. And people, people might, and listeners, you might know, remember that name, John O'Neill. First day as head of security of the World Trade Center, perished in the attacks. Now, Sergeant, I personally believe, looking at the documentation from the first World Trade Center attack, or bombing, I should say, that killed, 13 people, I believe. And looking at that, and looking at the FBI's, and you'll have to forgive me, people will have to forgive me if this seems insulting to anyone, but when you look at the FBI's involvement in that, that surveillance, that active participation surveillance of the first bombing of the World Trade Center, how that was handled, I've got a whole bunch of questions for those FBI agents that were taking orders from the top, I should say. And so I've got a whole lot of questions for the top. But having said all of that aside, let's talk about the meeting, your guys down at the World Trade Center, where you were going before I interrupted.
Yeah, about five members, RCMP members, went down to meet with, actually, the intent was for them to meet with the investigators for the Flight 800 investigation. Those guys were putting together the aircraft and investigating it. And our people wanted to meet with them to see what similarities there were. Somehow, things got rearranged by the inspector, and they met with O'Neill and his crew in the World Trade Center. There was intent to give description of the plane, description of the trace evidence that was found, of the incendiary device, the methods, and what have you. And it turns out of all of the, well, of the members who attended, I should have been the guy giving that information, because I was the only RCMP member with that knowledge. When I asked why I wasn't going, I was told because I had traveled too much. I'd been to Zurich twice, I'd been to Ottawa a couple of times, I'd been to Seattle, and I had spent too much time traveling. That seems like a lame excuse to me, but
yeah, you could have cashed in your freaking flyer miles. I'm joking, of course, but
yeah,
what a lame excuse that is.
That was a very lame excuse, especially when you see the results of the meeting. Number one, I was told this member who had arranged the meeting, his name was Carl, and he told me that when they arrived in New York at the World Trade Center for the meeting, Latham and O'Neill had a pre-meeting for about half an hour where they together met alone and discussed various things. What was discussed only today only Latham knows, because O'Neill perished. And both Carl and I suspected that the whole idea of Al-Qaeda and the incendiary device was played down. O'Neill was probably told that we don't have that much, and really it's speculation, and there was a concerted effort to keep the whole thing low-key. And when you read the final report that came out of that, one of the contributing factors for the major fire on board of the aircraft was dust balls.
Dust balls.
Dust balls.
The ugly stepsister to dust bunnies.
Dust bunnies.
Right. All right.
Yeah. And, you know, I didn't see any on the 15 planes that I examined, but, you know, there must have been a whole pile of them on Swiss Air 111. There wasn't. That was smoke and mirrors.
Tom, it's like what the Navy did today with the Government Accountability Office releasing some of their preliminary findings on the latest two U.S. naval crashes, saying that they had basically expired. They were not up to date on all their training missions. I think the USS John McCain had 6 out of 10 lapsed certifications, and they tried to blame this on, as part of the reasons why we had these two naval accidents, which really they don't tie in together, just like as you said, you know, blaming dust bunnies. I want to ask you this. You said this was undertaken as a check for any safety violations and not a criminal investigation. Was any criminal investigation ever done by any agency into this?
No. I correct that, because a partial one was conducted in Switzerland. One of the victims' families lodged a complaint with the Swiss, and I believe it was the Swiss Federal Police. And there was a news report over here, and it was commented on by our media relations person that the RCMP would cooperate fully with the Swiss police in any investigation that they wanted to conduct. At the very, very same time, I was in the hangar listening to the TSB members laugh at that whole concept. Oh, we don't cooperate with anybody, and we certainly aren't going to cooperate with a criminal investigation in Switzerland. And on the internet, you will find a speech, and it's in my website. You will find a speech given by the head of the TSB in which he basically states that they will not cooperate with a police investigation in any way.
Tom, tell listeners and viewers your website, just so people have that. It's in our program description.
It's www.twiceasfar.ca or swissair111.ca, and it's not the .com, it's .ca. I'm Canadian, and I can use the .ca because it's a Canadian site.
There you go. And proud, I know a number of Canadian authorities, shall we say, or people involved in CSIS and other agencies up there. So I think a lot of the training that you folks go through is really high class. Now, all right, so we connecting the dots. Here we are, 16 years post 9/11. Where do we stand? If we pull the lens of time and events backwards, and they're back a little bit, so we can expose the landscape, where are we at today with whether it be from Lockerbie to the present day? What's going on?
Well, I guess you have to look at it and wonder. You've got a number of plane crashes in the last 25, 30 years that were caused either were proven to be terrorists or are thought to be terrorists, and considerable amount of proof that they were caused by a terrorist incident. And then 9/11 occurred, and you guys, along with other countries, Britain and our guys, went into Afghanistan and found Osama bin Laden eventually. We haven't had a crash of a major intensity since. Now, either the aircraft technicians and the aircraft companies have drastically improved their methods and techniques, or we've killed the source of the crashes or the cause of the crashes. And I tend to think it's the latter.
Yeah, okay. I would agree. I mean,
would you? Okay.
I'm saying that this is the only time in my knowledge that we've seen a plane go down due to through a fire, through wiring.
Yeah. Well, think of TWA 800, though. What they attribute that to, and I know it's different.
Yeah, well, that's the one where they showed that there's no such thing as gravity.
Exactly.
They produced a video in which the plane blew apart, but the nose of the aircraft still climbed, 2,000 feet?
Oh, yeah. It was a tremendous cartoon, compliments of the CIA. I believe it was the CIA.
To come up with an explanation with, you know.
Right.
Yeah.
So I'm not so sure I would conclude. When you say, okay, it's the latter, Let's expand on that, just if you can, or if you don't mind, just I guess we're up against the network break here.
We got about a minute.
So you're saying that say that again. The causes have been.
Well, I personally, I think Osama bin Laden and Al Qaeda were responsible for a great number of incidents.
Okay.
And I read a book some time ago by an American author. He had been a key government head of an agency under Reagan, I believe it was. And his comment was that one day the terrorists will commit an offense that no one will be able to say was an accident. He was referring to 800 and several other air crashes that had occurred, including Swiss Air, in which it was coming out that they were accidents.
No.
They were.
Okay. And on the other side, I want to ask you, perhaps a troubling question, but I want to ask you a little bit about complicity. There seems to me an element of complicity here with some of these, not all of these, with some of these incidents. When I say complicity, I'm talking about perhaps a runaway investigation that gets covered up in the end. Our guest is retired RCMP Sergeant Tom Juby. His book, Twice as Far, The Swiss Air 111 Crash Investigation, which I've read, and it's a great, great investigative book. Going to be right back. Network break, 3 minutes. Don't go anywhere.
Just what kind of thriller predicts the future? In 3 days in the belly of the beast, Daniel Holdings wrote about the God Particle before CERN actually discovered the God Particle. In As the Darkness Falls, Daniel wrote about an Islamist terrorist confederacy that rose up out of Syria and declared a caliphate 3 years before ISIS was ever heard of. In his newest novel, Between the Veil, Daniel talks about a space between dimensions where supernatural beings can walk. He says that these novels are a warning from the Creator to its creation. Will war come to America? Will the world's economies collapse? Are we looking at increased earthquakes and volcanic activity? Will the United States fall into civil war? You can find all of Daniel's work at his website, danielholdings.com. That's danielholdings.com. All of these things and more are talked about in Daniel's books. To find out what's coming next, go to danielholdings.com.
Worldwide demand is making coconuts one of the highest yielding cash crops available today. Coca-Cola, Pepsi, and many high net worth individuals have invested billions of dollars into coconuts for strong growth and solid long-term income. Yields could be as high as 18% or more per year. Capital appreciation and exceptional income for up to 60 long years would be an absolutely brilliant investment to pass on to future generations. Diversify wisely with direct ownership of fully managed coconuts on prime farmland close to the beautiful Costa Rican border. For more information, qualified accredited investors should go to profitsincoconuts.com or phone 855-888-6288. That's 855-888-6288. This announcement does not constitute an offer to sell securities or a solicitation of an offer to purchase. Offer made by prospectus only. 855-888-6288 or visit profitsincoconuts.com. Profitsincoconuts.com.
You may never look at your city, town, or its people the same way ever again. Stained by Blood, a murder investigation based upon a true story by private investigator Douglas J. Hagman. Using the character Mark Stiles, Hagman takes you on a journey behind the scenes where the homicide becomes secondary to an underworld of satanic ritual abuse, child abduction, and even mind-controlled experimentation. For 5 years, a brutal killer remained on the loose, free to kill again. As Mark struggles to navigate the maze of bizarre twists and untangle a web of deeply hidden secrets kept by some of the most powerful and influential people in his community and beyond. Stained by Blood. Order your copy of this engaging novel today at HagmanandHagman.com and click on the link. Stained by Blood at HagmanandHagman.com and click on the link. Stained by Blood.